Thank you, Caleb. We're excited to have Caleb join the youth group next year, actually just a couple of weeks. So, looking forward to that. Good morning. Well, today I am excited to be able to preach the final sermon in this three-week series we've been working through called The Kingdom of Heaven is Like. Together we've been exploring some of Jesus' parables where he told us about the nature of the kingdom of heaven. First, we looked at the parable of the wheat and the weeds, and we learned that the kingdom is already in our midst. Jesus planted the seeds of the kingdom, and they're growing. There are followers of Jesus all over the world who are obeying him and doing his work. But the kingdom of Satan is also at work. He's trying to build his own kingdom. And so we live in the midst of that as well. Then last week, we talked about two parables. The parable of the treasure hidden in a field and the parable of the pearl of great value. And these two parables taught us that the value of the kingdom is great and that we should be willing to do whatever we have to or sacrifice whatever we have to in order to obtain it. So this week we're going to move on to one of the final parables that Jesus told in the book of Matthew about the kingdom. It's called the parable of the wise and foolish virgins. It's found in Matthew chapter 25, verses 1 through 13. This morning, I hope through this parable to answer another important question, namely, what do we do while we wait for the full realization of the kingdom of heaven? Waiting stinks, right? Nobody likes to wait. And usually, we will do just about anything in our power to avoid having to wait for anything. For example, my wife and I both love roller coasters. We love going to Cedar Point. We even went there on our honeymoon for one day. But amusement parks have some of the worst, most frustrating lines out there. Just waiting in that serpentine of metal poles and all that stuff as you just wait to get on the ride in the hot sun. And so I found that if you go to Cedar Point on one of the busier days of the summer and you try to ride one of the more popular, newer rides, you end up waiting at least 3 hours sometimes just to get on for the 15 seconds of excitement. So, little free word of advice. If you're planning a trip to Cedar Point, go on a Tuesday or a Wednesday and wait until the end of August. Because first of all, Tuesdays and Wednesdays tend to be the lowest attended days. And then in August, Ohio and Indiana schools go back to school, whereas Michigan waits till after Labor Day. And so you lose about two-thirds of the crowd. So, just keep that in mind if you're into roller coasters. At any rate, though, try as you might, there's no way to avoid lines completely. There's the line at the grocery store where how many of you are like me and you tend to always pick the slowest cashier, right? Or there's the wait at the doctor's office, which isn't it kind of weird how if you are running enough behind, then the doctor will cancel and you have to pay the rescheduling fee. But if the doctor's running late, you just have to deal with it. There's traffic. How many people had to wait in traffic this morning on Oakland Drive because the red light just kept changing every 5 seconds, it seemed like? It's so frustrating, right? Or traffic on the highway when it's a standstill because it's going down to one lane for construction or because of an accident. But probably the worst culprit of all is waiting at the Secretary of State office. Am I right? Because no matter how early you get there or what time of day or what day of the week, you are going to wait at least 45 minutes, right? Like a couple of weeks ago, Jennifer and I got a new vehicle, and so I had to go to the Secretary of State office to do a plate transfer. And so I thought, I'm gonna be smart, and I'm going to beat the rush. And I showed up 15 minutes before they opened. And there were at least 10 other people who thought that before I did. And so we're waiting in the little vestibule, you know, like the crowded little area, because it was cold outside, and so we were, you know, just huddled all up inside there. Finally, they opened, and we go and we take our numbers, and we sit down, and you would think that it would move quickly at that point, but still, they waited a while before any of the numbers got called. And so finally, my number's called, and I go to the desk, and I set my paperwork down, and I say, I need to do a plate transfer. And the teller says, what are you doing here? I said, I need to do a plate transfer. And then she proceeded to point out to me in the paperwork how the dealer had already processed that, and all I needed to do was switch the plate. It was all done. So I waited for nothing. the hatred of waiting in lines is actually universal. It's so universal that there's an entire field of mathematical research devoted to it called queuing theory. Has anybody heard of this? It actually was developed in the early 1900s when telephones first came out, because back then you had to call to an operator who manually ran a switchboard to be able to patch you through to the person you wanted to talk to. And so the telephone companies realized that there was a balance they had to try to achieve. They had too many operators on hand. They were paying for, you know, for lost time. But if there weren't enough, then customers had to wait too long and got upset. And so this whole branch of study developed out of that, trying to perfect the art of waiting. So one of the most basic yet important lessons that has come out of this field of queuing theory is that it's not actually the duration of the wait that's the problem. It's how people experience the wait. For example, queuing theorists point out three different problems that they have to try to overcome to create a better experience of waiting. The first problem is it's boring to wait. This is why when you go to a busy restaurant, in the waiting area there will be big TVs, or maybe they'll hand out free breadsticks. Or do you ever get one of those coasters that lights up and vibrates when it's your turn? So you don't have to think about the fact that you're waiting. It's just, you know, you can go ahead and do other things. Problem number two is the uncertainty of how long we'll have to wait. So this is the frustration at red lights. Because even if in reality that light only lasts 20 or 30 seconds, it feels like 10 minutes, right? Especially if you're running behind. In fact, because of this, around the world there's places where they're developing red lights with timers on them, or countdowns, so that it will, in theory, put drivers at ease because they know how long they're going to have to experience the wait. And the idea here is that it should reduce road rage and reduce accidents as people are just put a little bit more at ease while they wait. Now, on the other hand, some studies have also been done on putting timers on green lights. You can probably guess how that works out, right? It actually increases accidents. You can figure that one out on your own. Then problem number three is our sense of injustice when someone who shows up after us is served before us. For example, who's ever been on the highway? Probably all of you could raise your hands, and they're going down to one lane for construction, and everybody's getting over into the one lane, but there's the one guy who zooms around everybody and cuts in at the last second. Who's experienced that? Leave your hand up if you are that guy. Nobody's admitting it. Okay. Fair enough. Or to a lesser extent, this is the frustration you feel when you're in the line at the supermarket and the other lanes are all moving faster than yours, which actually is why some stores like Best Buy have moved to a system where everybody waits in one line and then the next available cashier is the one who serves the next person, which actually does nothing to increase the overall speed of service. The only thing that it's doing is it's making the customers happy because they feel like it's being treated fairly. So ultimately, when we're in situations where you know that you're going to need to wait, if you can handle it creatively and if you can approach it intentionally, then the length of time that you have to wait is actually rendered almost meaningless. The issue is not the wait itself. The issue is how prepared we are for the wait. And I think this is exactly what Jesus is teaching us in this parable of the 10 virgins, or the wise and foolish virgins, found in Matthew 25, 1 through 13. If you're using one of our pew Bibles, you can find it on page 986. It reads, "Then the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went to meet the bridegroom. Five of them were foolish and five were wise. For when the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them, but the wise took flasks of oil with their lamps. As the bridegroom was delayed, they all became drowsy and slept. But at midnight there was a cry, 'Here is the bridegroom, come out to meet him.' Then all those virgins rose and trimmed their lamps. And the foolish said to the wise, 'Give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out.' But the wise answered, saying, 'Since there will not be enough for us and for you, go rather to the dealers and buy for yourselves.' And while they were going to buy, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with him to the marriage feast, and the door was shut. Afterward, the other virgins came also, saying, 'Lord, Lord, open to us.' But he answered, 'Truly I say to you, I do not know you. Watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour. Now, this is somewhat of a confusing parable because while it's obvious that we're talking about a wedding, the differences between a first century Jewish wedding and a 21st century American wedding are vastly apart from each other. And so there's a lot of elements of the story that get lost in translation. Now, I've had the privilege of being able to do several weddings since I became ordained. And it's actually one of my favorite things that I get to do as a pastor. You'd think that the pressure would really be on when you're doing a wedding, but I've actually found the opposite to be true. Because believe it or not, nobody goes to a wedding to see the pastor. Everybody is there for the bride, right? It's about her day. And so if you do what the bride wants you to do, everybody's happy. But in first century Israel, that was not the case. In fact, it was, if anything, it wasn't about the bride at all. It was about the groom, or more specifically about his family and the arrangement that he was making with the bride's family. Jewish marriages would begin with a betrothal, which was similar to an engagement of our day. And this would happen in two stages. First of all, at a young age, probably around 12 or 13 years old, the parents of both parties would pledge their son and their daughter to get married to each other. Which any of our young people, you know, looking forward to marriage someday, imagine that, your parents choosing and pledging when you were 12 years old who you're going to marry. So then any given amount of time later, they would transition on to the second stage of betrothal, which was a negotiation between the parents of the bride and the parents of the groom. They were negotiating about the bride price and all sorts of other elements of the wedding. And so during this phase of the betrothal, the couple might actually refer to themselves as husband and wife. But they wouldn't live together. There would be no relationship physically with each other. But if at this point they decided they wanted to separate, then it would require a divorce. And so this wasn't quite marriage, but it also was a lot more binding than an engagement of today. An example of that is if you read the Gospel of Matthew or of Luke, where Joseph was pledged to be married to Mary, but they weren't married yet. It obviously was more binding or more intense than an actual engagement of today, but yet was not quite a marriage yet either. And so the second stage of betrothal could last up to a year, with the negotiations going right up until the wedding ceremony at times. And so when the wedding finally took place, it was an elaborate and lengthy event, and often the entire village would get involved in it. Once the negotiations were finished, the groom would leave his house and travel to the house of the bride in a processional. And then the bride would join the processional at that point, along with her attendants, and they would march back to the groom's house where the union would be completed. And so only members of the wedding party or their close friends or invitees to the wedding would be part of this processional. And often participants in the processional would carry lamps or lanterns with them, signifying that they were part of the group. And so anybody who tried to join and didn't have that lantern would be immediately recognized as a party crasher. Now, since the negotiations could be lengthy and the distance between the homes could be a great distance, there was no exact timetable as to when the bride could expect the groom to show up. And so it wouldn't have been uncommon for the bride to send people out ahead of her to look for the groom and to announce that he was on his way. So knowing some of these customs sort of puts the parable that Jesus is telling us into perspective. Now, I remember reading this story a long time ago and coming across this phrase, there were 10 virgins waiting for a bridegroom, and I thought, are these all supposed to be the bride? Who are these people? Like, how is that in the Bible? But that's not the case. And in fact, none of these women would have been the bride. They would have been attendants to the bride, or what we would call today bridesmaids. So they would have gone out ahead of the bride to wait for the groom so that they could announce that he was on his way. And Jesus gives the impression that at this point when they went out, it was already getting dark because they took lamps along with them. So perhaps that's why they even went out to begin with. Maybe the groom was supposed to arrive during the daytime, and as it was getting later, they went out to see what was taking him so long. Now, Jesus tells us that 5 of these women were wise and took extra oil along with them, and the other 5 were foolish and didn't take any extra oil. I'm sure all of them hoped that the groom was going to show up soon, but the foolish ones assumed that was the case, that he would be there any minute. And so the wise virgins, on the other hand, planned for a delay, and that's exactly what ended up happening. The groom took his time, the delay got lengthened, and all the women fell asleep until they were awakened by someone shouting that the groom had come, or he was on his way. And so at this point, the foolish ones wake up and realize that they are running out of oil. And so they ask the wise if they can borrow some, but there wasn't enough to go around. So it might sound at this point like the wise ones were being selfish. They weren't sharing. But the reality was, if they had shared, then nobody would have had enough oil to last through the whole processional. And so they send the five foolish ones out to find some more. But along the way, the groom shows up, the bride is retrieved, the party makes it back to the groom's house for the wedding, and the five foolish virgins are left outside. Now, I'm not sure if this was one of the customs of the day for the doors of the wedding to close at this point and to not let anybody else in, but in Jesus' story, this is exactly what happens. And so when the five foolish ones finally show up, they knock on the door and the groom turns them away, saying he doesn't know them. Now the question is, what does this parable mean? Well, Jesus gives us our first clue in the opening sentence. Where most of the other parables that we've looked at in the series begin with the kingdom of heaven is like, or the kingdom of heaven has been compared to, this parable begins a little differently and says that the kingdom of heaven will be like. In other words, Jesus is talking about an aspect of the kingdom that has not happened yet. He's saying that the kingdom of heaven is not like this now, but someday in the future, perhaps soon, it will be like this. So what will it be like? Well, first of all, let's look at the elements of the story. I believe that the 10 virgins represent potential followers of Jesus. They're people who are aware of the kingdom and potentially are even longing to be a part of it. But for the wise ones, they're prepared for it and they ultimately become a part of the kingdom, while the foolish ones do not. The bridegroom represents Jesus. In fact, this is a title that he used of himself several times throughout the Gospels and in the book of Revelation. He talked about the bridegroom being delayed, which might seem odd considering the fact that Jesus is the one speaking at this point, so he's obviously there. But what he's talking about is a time in the future when the kingdom of heaven will be like this. And so he's speaking about his second coming. Now, a lot of students of the Bible get a little hung up on what's the significance of the oil and the lamps. We're going to come back to this. But just for now, focus on the fact that these items are there to show the level of preparedness of these 10 women, or of followers of Jesus, as we wait for the kingdom. And then finally, the wedding represents the kingdom of heaven itself, specifically the fully realized or established kingdom of heaven when Jesus returns and reigns over all things. So this is the ultimate destination of everyone who puts their faith in Jesus and follows him. And currently, the kingdom is open to anyone. The door is wide open. But as Jesus talks about in the parable, there's a time coming when the door will be shut. So now what do we learn from this parable? Well, first of all, I believe that Jesus wanted to teach us the uncertainty of the timing for his return. And this is actually a lesson that he began teaching a chapter earlier with a series of teachings and parables starting in Matthew 24:36, where he said, "But concerning that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven nor the Son, but the Father only." Now, his disciples never quite understood what he was talking about. They didn't get the message, but Jesus had warned them that the ultimate point of his initial ministry on earth was to die and to rise again for the forgiveness of sins and for the redemption of humanity. But he also promised that he would come back. And the thing is, he never said when he was going to come back. In fact, in this verse, he tells us that nobody can know when he's coming back. And so this leads us to potentially making one of two different mistakes. First mistake we can make is to assume that his delay is absolutely going to be long, perhaps not even within our lifetimes or within our children's lifetimes. And Jesus expounds on this mistake in a parable about a wicked servant that he tells a few verses after this last one we just read, verse 48 of Matthew chapter 24, where it says, "But if that wicked servant says to him, 'My master is delayed,' and begins to beat his fellow servants and eats and drinks with drunkards, the master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him and at an hour he does not know." So this is the mistake of procrastinators. Anybody a procrastinator in the room? Let's work on that tomorrow, okay? This is the kind of This is the kind of person that says, I have all the time in the world, and then proceeds to goof around with that time right up until the precious last moment when they realize they've run out of it. Now, most colleges are going through final exams either this week or in the next couple of weeks to come. And so this is the mistake that thousands of students are just about to regret that they've made. I know I regretted this quite a few times when I was in college. But in this situation that Jesus tells us about, the consequences are far more serious. When the five foolish virgins in Jesus' parable finally do make it to the house, they find that the door has been shut. The bridegroom says to them, I do not know you, and he turns them away. And again, the story, or the kingdom of heaven, is represented in this story by the wedding. And so when the door of the wedding is closed, he's talking about the day when the door of the kingdom of heaven would be closed. Right now it's open. You're invited to be a part of it. Anyone can join. It's as easy as calling on the name of Jesus and believing in him and confessing your sins to him. But remember that the kingdom will be like this, according to the parable. The door is open now, but in the future, the kingdom will be shut. The opportunity to make that choice to enter will eventually be over. And you'll either be in because you went through the door, or you'll be out because you chose not to. And so if I'm understanding this parable and really the rest of Scripture correctly, then there's two ways for that door to close. The first, as this parable emphasizes for us, is that the bridegroom can show up. It's when Jesus returns, he gathers his church, and he establishes his kingdom fully. Now, some people refer to this time as the apocalypse because of the destruction that this implies for everything that is not part of the kingdom. This is a very dramatic way for the door to close. But there's also a much more subtle and individual way that the door can close. And that's for any given person to reach the end of their life. It's very possible that the world as a whole is not headed toward the apocalypse anytime soon. But each individual person is headed toward one, ultimately at some point in our life when we reach the end of it. And so Jesus is asking us to contemplate the question, which side of the door am I on now? And again, he's inviting us to walk through it. So the warning that Jesus gives here is that we can't simply ignore his command to love God and love one another and just live whatever way we see fit, thinking that someday we'll just get right with God and be able to make some changes. Because the reality is we don't know how long we have until the door closes. Jesus might return while we're deciding to ignore him. And so instead, he's saying that true followers of Jesus and true members of the kingdom should live every single day, every single moment, knowing for sure which side of the door that they're on and ready for Jesus to come and to establish his kingdom. But erring too far in that direction can lead us to another mistake, which is to assume that Jesus' return is short, or that his delay is short and his return is imminent. Now, all 10 of these bridesmaids wanted to follow the bridegroom to the wedding. And all of them, to some extent, got ready. But the five women that Jesus called foolish made the assumption that the groom was very close. And so they only took a little bit of oil for their lamps. We realize that they were only ready superficially. When the groom was delayed in coming, it revealed the fact that they were completely unprepared for Jesus. The parable teaches us a critical truth, that there is a vast difference between wanting the kingdom of heaven and actually preparing for the kingdom of heaven. So despite Jesus teaching that the timing of his return is unknowable, and that it might very well be delayed a long time, it hasn't stopped scores of people from trying to predict it and figure out the exact day when it will happen. We've seen this throughout decades of people trying to guess the date. This is not preparation. This is wishful thinking. And it's a type of wishful thinking that Jesus specifically told us not to engage in. Now, one of the more famous predictions and one of the more recent ones was that Jesus would return for his church on May 21st of 2011. And this prediction was by the late Harold Camping. Does anybody remember this a few years back? Camping was a pastor and a Christian radio host who warned that approximately 2 million Christians around the world would be raptured on May 21st, 2011, and that the event would coincide with massive earthquakes and other natural disasters, ultimately judging the rest of the world. And he believed that the culmination of all of this was that there was going to be a judgment day on October 21st of 2011, just a couple of months later, where God would wipe out everybody who had survived to that point. So Camping obviously was not the first person to make this sort of prediction, and he sadly probably won't be the last one. But what makes his claim stand out from a lot of the others is that he was able to get hundreds, if not thousands, of people to follow along with him. And not only follow him, but invest their time and their money into it. These are some of the billboards that Camping and his followers purchased. If you went to any Tiger games that summer, there was one of these right outside of Comerica Park. So you might have seen one. Camping got his followers to spend every last dime that they had to try to warn people about the end of the world. A lot of them quit their jobs and moved into large cities so they could stand on street corners and warn people that the end was coming on May 21st. So this wasn't just a shot-in-the-dark prediction that people were able to kind of scoff at and laugh at when it turned out not to be true. He had thousands of people staking their lives on the reality of this prediction that turned out to be false. And so what happened on May 21st and then on October 21st, when those days came and went, and obviously the rapture of the church did not happen, and Judgment Day didn't happen? For most of us, we shook our heads and said, yeah, we told you so, we knew that wasn't going to happen. But for many of Camping's followers, their troubles had just started. A lot of them found themselves homeless, completely broke, without jobs, and perhaps worst of all, disillusioned spiritually. Many of them were interviewed later and talked about how they had lost their faith, not just their faith in Harold Camping and his prediction, but their faith in God altogether. They'd been completely rattled by being wrong about this prediction. I believe that this has to be one of the reasons that Jesus said no one can know the day or the hour of his return. These parables that Jesus taught show us that as Christians, we must live in this tension of on one side, hoping and being ready for Jesus to return at any moment, but then on the other side, being ready for the reality that it might not happen until the distant future. Assuming a long delay might lead to spiritual laziness. On the other hand, assuming a short delay might lead to foolish and hasty actions. But what does it look like to be ready and hopeful for Jesus while also being prepared for a long life in the event that he doesn't return in our lifetimes? Well, first of all, let's talk about this aspect of being ready spiritually or being ready for Jesus. Now, if Jesus were to return right now, how many people who claim to be Christians would be caught off guard, having never really gotten serious about their faith? How many of us would still be living in sins that we never really got around to dealing with? How many of us would have never gotten around to obeying the calling that God has put on our lives? The call to love him, to love others, to humbly serve him in various ways. In the first message of this series, I mentioned how Jesus began his teaching ministry in Matthew 4:17 by preaching, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand." Repent in this case means that we turn away from our sin and point ourselves in the direction of Jesus, and we move toward him. So this is the key element of being ready for Jesus. We move away from sin. We move toward Jesus. So have you confessed your sin to him? Have you asked him into your life to save you? Is your life pointed in the direction of Jesus, and are you moving toward him? Toward the truth that he taught, toward the compassion and the grace that he extended to others? Can you do more than just call yourself a Christian, but actually be a follower of Jesus? Because that's ultimately what he means when he says to be ready for him to come. It's not just about looking the part, being born into the right family, attending the right church, being a good enough person. It's about allowing Jesus to transform your life from the inside out. So the good news is if that describes you, then you're ready for him to return. And you might even be hoping for him to return soon. But again, don't make the other mistake of assuming that his return is absolutely a long way off. Or I'm sorry, is absolutely soon. Because we also have to be prepared for the potential that it won't be. You have to be ready to wait. And again, as we talked about before, waiting is difficult. But remember, it's not the length of time that we have to wait that's the problem. It's how we deal with the wait. It's how prepared we are for the wait. Which begs the question, how prepared are we to wait for Jesus? Well, for the five women in his parable, being prepared for the long wait meant that they carried extra oil with them. These women knew that in order to be part of the groom's processional, they had to have their lamp and it had to be lit. But on a more practical level, they needed light to see. It was dark outside. In other words, being prepared is as simple as making wise use of the skills and the gifts and the resources that God has given us, both inside of the church, but also in the community, in the world. Christians are called to do things like spiritual growth and worship and spreading the gospel and building up the church. But we're also called to be good and functioning members of society outside of the church and the community at large. In other words, both our spiritual lives and our earthly lives matter. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 11 and 12, Paul wrote, "And aspire to live quietly and to mind your own affairs and to work with your hands as we instructed you, so that you may walk properly before outsiders and be dependent on no one." Then in the book of 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 12, Peter writes something similar, where he says, "Keep your conduct among Gentiles honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation." The type of preparedness that Jesus urged his followers to have was not some kind of supernatural secret. I think he was saying to simply be prepared to live a good, moral, productive life in the midst of the church and in the community, and to do this every single day. He was saying to go on living life, or living the life that God has called you to, and to do it in such a way that it brings glory to God no matter what you're doing, so that you inspire those both outside of the church and inside of it to pursue him as well. So whatever your profession is, be the best at it that you can be and show that Christians are hard workers and that they're assets to their employers. Wherever you live, be a good neighbor. Show that followers of Jesus are trustworthy and friendly and helpful. As you shop and learn and have fun and otherwise interact in the community around you, do it in such a way that it makes people glad to have Christians living among them. If we're going to invite people to be a part of the kingdom of heaven, we need to show them, or do the best that we can to show them, that the kingdom of heaven is worth being a part of. And we do that by the way we live out our lives each day. Now, one other observation here is that both the wise and the foolish virgins in this story fell asleep while they were waiting for the groom. But there was a difference between what they were doing when they fell asleep, because the wise fell asleep with the knowledge that they had extra oil for their lamps, while the foolish ones fell asleep completely unprepared. Now think about this. Have you ever been getting ready to go on a trip, maybe a vacation or something for work, and you knew that you had to leave in the morning, and the night before you still hadn't packed, and you went to bed anyway? Or maybe you've had a presentation at work or at school or a project that was due, and you weren't ready for it the night before. It was coming up in the morning, and you went to sleep not being prepared. How did that work out for you? How easily did you sleep that night? Or were you tossing and turning the whole night? Now, on the other hand, if you go to bed the night before the big trip or the night before the presentation, and you're packed or you're studied up, you know that you have all your talking points down, or you know that you have all of your things in order, you might be a little anxious still, but for the most part, your mind is at ease and you can rest peacefully. I think that's the situation these 10 virgins found themselves in. The wise slept knowing that they were prepared, whereas the foolish slept potentially anxiously knowing they weren't. When we're ready for Jesus to come soon and we are prepared for the long potential wait in front of us, it puts us at ease to live the peaceful and honorable lives that he called us to, that Paul and that Peter talked about in those verses. But sometimes I wonder if some of those people that predict the date of Jesus' return, or the people who are seemingly desperate for it to happen soon, are just not prepared for the rigors of living for Jesus day in and day out over the long haul. I have to admit, there was one time in my life where I earnestly prayed that Jesus would return. And not just like return at some point, but like that moment I wanted him to return. And I know you probably think it was a really profound moment, like somebody was suffering that I knew and I wanted it to end or something like that. But no, that's not it. Not even close. It was actually when I was in eighth grade, and it was the first time I had ever attempted to ride one of the big roller coasters at Cedar Point. The Magnum XL200, which at the time was the largest, or one of the largest and fastest roller coasters in the world. And some of my friends convinced me to go on this ride. And so that first hill, it seemed like it took 20 minutes to get to the top. We're just going click, click, click. And I'm looking down and I'm seeing all of the people on the ground looking like ants. And we're going click, click, click. And I just started to pray, Jesus, please come back now. Because I thought it was the only option that I had to get out of that situation unscathed. But I made it. I was not prepared for going down the big hill, but I survived. Oops. And I have the picture to prove it. Would you believe I paid money for this? Look at the sheer look of terror on my face. I'm just going to go away from that. I think a lot of Christians are not prepared for dealing with sin, or for facing persecution, or for obeying Jesus and living the quiet, honorable, peaceful life that he called us to day in and day out, year after year. And so it's easier to be like the wicked servant in Jesus' parable that went about just living however he wanted to, thinking he had time to get everything in order down the road. Or it's easier to be like the five foolish women in the story who convinced themselves that the return was coming immediately, to convince yourself that there's a supernatural end to all of this difficulty coming any minute now. It might be, but we don't know that. And so building the kingdom here and now, living for the kingdom while we're on earth, it's tough, but it's what Jesus calls us to do. And so I hope this morning that you're ready for Jesus. But I also hope that you're prepared to live the life he's called you to live for the long haul while you're waiting for him. And whatever time that you and I and everybody else that's part of the church has left, my hope is that we can devote it to living the best lives for Jesus that we can, so that we can build his kingdom here and now, and so that we can invite other people to be a part of it and show them that it's worth being a part of. Would you pray with me? Jesus, we thank you for dying for us and for rising again so that we have a way to be a part of your kingdom. We thank you that you have taught us all of these things through your parables and other teachings about what we can expect the kingdom to be like and how you want us to live in the midst of it. We pray that we could honor you with our lives by living in the way that you taught us to live. Father, for those that are not part of your kingdom, I just pray that you would impress that on them to make that decision, to walk through that door.